Hello and welcome to Crime Time FM. I'm Paul Burke and I write about crime fiction. And here's where I interview authors about their latest novels. Now my guest today is David Hewson, a professional writer for more than two decades, with several best-selling novels under his belt, including the Nick Costa series, the Killing Trilogy, and most recently three books set in Venice, all of which we'll discuss. Hewson's latest novel, however, just out, is a bit of a departure. It's called Baptiste, The Blade Must Fall. I have to say I was fascinated by the idea of taking a character from TV, one that many of us already know. I mean, you might remember The Missing and its offshoot Baptiste, about the haunted detective played by Chechi Carrillo. And imagining that man younger, what would make Baptiste, the man we see on television in The Missing, the man he is? This novel is sort of a personal origin story, giving us answers to that question. But I'll let David Hewson explain more. Hello and welcome to Crime Time FM, David.
Good morning, Paul. Lovely to see you again.
Yeah, good morning. Nice to see you too, sir. I'm just wondering, you know, Baptiste is a new novel and a new direction. But I get the sense you like to move on. You like to explore new ideas and new themes. Would that be fair to say?
Absolutely. You know, I did with the Nick Costa series, I did the thing of a long-running series with, you know, the same cast and the same pretty much location. And I enjoyed it greatly. But I'm not someone who likes to sit still. And I think it's good for a writer to be challenged rather than to kind of do the same thing over and over again. So, you know, after Costa, you know, I did The Killing, then I did some script writing, I did some Shakespeare adaptations, these Venice books, and now Baptiste. So yeah, I do like to move around a little bit. I'm not the sort of writer who could write 25 books with the same characters and stay fresh. And I admire people who can manage to do that. It must be pretty hard. I don't read the same kind of book all the time, so I don't feel I should write the same kind of book really.
No, I suppose that's true. And you don't want to get typecast. I mean, obviously, a lot of it's led by sales and things anyway. But I suppose you have to be a bit unsentimental about it, really.
No, I don't know about that. This is a new thing. If you look at something like Robert Louis Stevenson, he could write horror. He could write travel. He could write crime. He could write historic. And nobody ever said, you know, oh, you wrote Kidnap. You've got to keep writing Kidnap. Yeah, or you've got to keep writing Treasure Island. You know, back then it was quite normal for writers to move around and do things. And actually 30 years ago when I first came into this business, it wasn't, you know, a big deal. But now everything has to have a label on it and a tag and a label and a sub-label often. And I don't really think in those terms. You know, I just think in terms of being a storyteller. I didn't realize I was a crime writer until about a few years in when somebody told me, and I thought, well, fine, you know, I don't mind being called a crime writer.
Right. But you're just writing the stories you want to write.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And some of the books I've written, I don't think are crime. You know, if you look at a book like The Garden of Angels, I mean, that's pretty much a straight novel. And Baptiste, you know, he is a cop and there is a crime at the heart of it, but it's not a simple whodunit. You know, I do actually like to play with ideas and themes and I do something different. You know, I'm not trying to be in the middle of the road or the mainstream. I like to do things that are a bit on the edge and maybe challenge the readers a little bit. I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. And when we talk about Baptiste, we can get into that. In fact, we'll talk about some of the other books before we start, but I suppose one of the prerequisites of all this, of course, is you need to have lots of ideas. So do ideas sort of come to you easily?
I've never, ever been short of ideas. I mean, the difficulty is picking the right one. I mean, I'm always astonished when people say I've got no ideas what to write about because, you know, the world is just full of things. I mean, a good way to start off is to find something you're angry about.
Right.
Anger's a great source of storytelling, I think. And a lot of my books stem from anger about something other, you know, a personal anger. You know, The Garden of Angels, my personal anger about the state of the world. And Baptiste, really, we can talk about this in more detail later, but that was kicked off by an angry reaction about something as well. So, yeah, I've never found a shortage of ideas. I mean, the problem is I've got too damn many and you've got to pick the right one, you know.
Yeah, I suppose. And I suppose you don't know until you start following an idea where it'll actually go.
I've been doing this for a long time now. Right. I've had more than 30 books published. So you get a sense of when things aren't working and when you've either got to radically redraw them or just give them up, you know, do something else. You know, I have a stack of started books on my system that I will probably never, ever get around to finishing because I wasn't quite happy with the way they were going.
Right.
But in a way it's easy for me because this is what I do for a living. You know, I don't have any other job. Yes. You know, I've been a full-time writer now for more than 20 years. Mm. So I've got the time to make mistakes and try to learn a bit as you go along. Not that you ever learn how to write. You just learn how to learn about writing. I've never been short of inspiration. It's just picking the right bit.
When you say that about learning to write, I mean, you polish, you know, style, all those sorts of things. You do change over the years. You get better at it. Of course you do because you've been doing it for 30 years. But what about what has changed actually in terms of your intent with your writing or your style with your writing? Can you notice a change over the 30 years, or is it sort of each book has its own mood, its own?
Oh, no, it's definitely changed. Yeah, I mean, it has definitely changed. You know, when you're starting out, you're amazed that you're getting published at all, and you're terribly needy. You know, you want people to look at you, and you want people to notice you. So, you know, my early books were quite violent and quite controversial sometimes at times. Mm. Because you felt that's what you needed to do. You know, there was this classic thing that people put into their early crime books of a really obscure, you know, you try to think of the most obscure murder and bizarre murder you can possibly put in there.
Right.
You know, somebody get and flayed alive or something like that, because you felt that's what was needed. But over the years, I've come to think that books are more about people than they are about events. So I think over the years I focus more on character rather than trying to put in some, you know, very bizarre event at the end of every chapter so there's a cliffhanger. I mean, that isn't really my style of writing. It's not to say that that style of writing is wrong or anything. You know, I mean, all books are different, thank God for that, because it would be terrible if we were all writing the same thing. But I mean, my books have moved more to being about people and less about events, and certainly less about violence. I do have certain approaches on violence now that I didn't have 20 years ago when I was starting off writing the Costa series. I mean, there's some very explicit violence in those early books.
But in fairness, there was explicit and violent things going on in the place you were writing about as well.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, you can't shy away from it. I mean, my attitude to violence is that if you are going to depict it, firstly, I don't want it to be lurid. I don't want it to be lingering. Secondly, I want it to be shocking. You know, I mean, there's one particular piece of violence in Baptiste, and I want people to recoil from it because it's terrible. It is shocking. It should not be happening. And I don't think, you know, you can kind of sugarcoat that. I think if it's going to be in there, it has got to be shocking. But I think the other thing that I wouldn't do is, you know, I don't believe in this idea that the good guys win by having a bigger gun than the bad guys.
Right.
I don't see violence as being an answer to violence. Mm. And I think it's quite important to point out in the story that violence has ripple effects, both on the victims and on the perpetrators. You know, it's not a simple equation. So, I mean, my books tend to be in the grey area rather than the black and white good guys against bad guys thing, which is something I've developed over the years, really.
Yeah. No, and I think that makes a lot of sense, because what I see in a sense is when you're talking about character, it's the impact of the violence. And as you said, it's on the perpetrator. We'll see that when we talk a little bit about Baptiste. But the point is that the violence comes across in the context of that human effect much more in the later books. I also see, I think, a little bit more humor sometimes, you know, with the dark.
Yeah.
There's a dark undertone. Even when you write lighter books, there's a dark undertone that's there, but there's always a humor and there's always a little tilt at pomposity and things like that in your books, I think.
Yeah. You know, I mean, they are entertainments. I mean, particularly the, you know, the two Venice books I've done, the Medici Murders and the Borgia Portrait, were basically from lockdown when I couldn't get to Venice. And I was struggling to find out what to write. And I thought, well, I'll write something that is an entertainment that will take people on a kind of virtual tour of bits of Venice that I love on the general track. But also, you know, to have a bit of a serious story underneath that about a man who is coming to terms with being recently widowed and doesn't have a direction in life, and about in the Medici Murders, a particularly nasty English historian who, you know, I see him as a kind of cross between Nigel Farage, Jeremy Clarkson, and David Starkey. So he's not going to get out of that book alive. There's no way he's going to get out of that book alive. I'm not giving away a spoiler there, really.
No. But,
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think, you know, I think books need to entertain. You know, I don't want people to be totally depressed. I mean, The Garden of Angels is a very serious book about a very serious subject, but I would hope it's also entertaining, that it takes you to aspects of history that most people don't know and parts of Venice that most people don't know. So, yeah, if there isn't any entertainment, I think you probably failed.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And they are entertaining. And you've got the brilliantly named Marmaduke Godolphin there, who's
Marmaduke.
That sets you against him before anything else, doesn't it? Hearing the name.
He is a horror. He is a horror, yeah. Yeah.
But you're no fan of this sort of... sorry, I cut across you there.
Yeah. I'm no fan of...
The sort of historic... This pop history program sometimes that they do on TV.
No, it's when they do these reenactions, which I've seen. And, you know, I do know a fair bit about Italian history, so I can spot when they're faking it. You know, and you see things sometimes and you just think, you know, this guy's a professional historian who's running along with this cod theory about Caravaggio or whatever and tennis match and killing people that, you know, they're just not proven. They're just myths. And I think that, you know, I think in history, you have to say when something's a myth, you know, I think.
Yeah, right.
It's not, history's not just entertainment. You know, there has to be something where people say.
Yeah, you have a response.
Well, we think this happened, you know.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. I'm not a fan of the ones where actually there's one revelation and it comes an hour into the program when they've got you through a story you know very, very well. But they found out one tiny little fact, and that's the thing they keep to the end, and they go on for an hour before they get there.
Yes.
Anyway,
often it's not really a fact. You know,
and it's not really much of anything at all anyway. Yeah. But anyway, back to Venice and back to those novels, because as you said, the Garden of Angels is a darker novel, but it is an entertainment. Of course it is. In fact, I think it's a very thrilling book. It's one of those books that totally enraptures you. But then you've got the Medici Murders and the Borgia Portraits. And I think it's the Medici Murders, and I'm going to misquote now, but the line is something like, every stone has a ghost and everywhere a story, or round every corner a story.
Yeah, right? I think that's the beginning of the Borgia Portrait, that one, isn't it? Yeah. Every stone's a ghost. Yeah, yeah. I mean, but that is Venice. You know, when you get to know it, they are real people, famous people, unknown people. Their stories are written in the stones and the places. Just the same as it was. And, you know, and this came about, I mean, the Medici Murders, the first one came about because just around the corner from where I stay, and I've read so many history books about Venice, I knew that Lorenzino de' Medici had been assassinated 11 years after murdered his own cousin, who was then the Duke of Florence. And I just thought, that's a fascinating story. You know, what really happened there? When I dug into it, it just grew ever more fascinating, because a very clever Venetian academic called Stefano Dall'Aglio, who is actually an academic at Ca' Foscari, the Venetian University, he dug into some records and discovered, and it was only around about 2008, that everything we thought about who'd ordered Lorenzino's assassination was wrong. It was found a document in Madrid that proved it was Charles V rather than Cosimo de' Medici, who was the successor of the murdered one, who'd actually nailed him down. And I just thought, you know, that kind of academic detective work is fascinating. And that kind of gave me the spark for thinking, well, maybe I'll invent another theory about Lorenzino's assassination and put that in front of the dreadful Marmaduke Godolphin and let him swallow it.
Yeah. What about then? I mean, are you going to do more of the Medici murder books, the Arnold Clovers?
I hope so. I mean, I'm playing around with something now. But yeah, I'd certainly like to do more. I don't want to do just that. You know, I don't want to get typecast into being it. And, you know, the people who love Venice books love it. And I keep getting messages saying, when's the next one out? There won't be another one this year. Hopefully next year, there'll be another one, which again will take a particular strand of history in Venice that people may vaguely know about and turn it over and over and show people that actually there's an awful lot more to it. I mean, in a way, those Venice books are kind of literary archaeology, because you just lift up these stones and in reality there's so much underneath it and so much connects with someone else. I mean, when I was writing the Borgia portrait, and at the heart of that is this fictional erotic portrait of Lucrezia Borgia. And, you know, some people said to me, oh, well, you know, well, she was a Borgia. She was in Rome. What's she got to do with Venice? Well, actually, her connection to Venice are very, very strong. Mm. One of the lovers was a very famous Venetian aristocrat and poet. And so, that, you know, everything connects in Venice over the centuries. You know, you can see, you know, she's connected to Pietro Bembo. Pietro Bembo is connected to Aldus Manutius, who's the man who gave us the first paperback books. Later, Lord Byron swanning through Venice and with a very colourful love life, picked up a hank of Lucrezia's hair in Turin, I think it was. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are lots of things that you can hook together there. And I like it when things
kind of
connect.
These things kind of, in your mind, you kind of put them all together and
and then afterwards, you know, when you've written the book and just think, you know, I have to check it all and I got it right, and it does astonish me, you know, that how complex the webs of the and the interlinked networks of lovers and friends and enemies, how they really are astonishing. So yeah, I haven't given up on Venice, but I'm not going to get tied down to doing a book a year there.
And funnily enough, I suppose it comes from the fact that it has such a unique history, its own republic and so on. You've got the literary history as well. You know, I mean, Casanova, in fact, comes up in the books too.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, so much came from Venice that we don't appreciate. I mean, music, you know, Monteverdi, Vivaldi.
Yes.
Opera, you know, was partly the invention of Venice. A lot of music that moved on from the Baroque era came from Venice, but on a more prosaic level, the Venetians were fantastic at government. They were the most organized civil service you could possibly think of. And, you know, again, there's more for me to write there. If you go into the back of the Doge's palace, not the public part, you get into the parts where the civil service worked, and they were huge and incredibly organized. They had a room that was totally dedicated to code makers and code breakers.
Right. Because
they invented a lot of cryptography.
Yes.
And the archives where Arnold finds himself with his mate Luca Volpetti are absolutely vast. I mean, they're so vast, they're on all the way to the back of the Friary Church. And then there's another lot of them over on Giudecca. You know, there were documents, boring bills of lade and tax and things like that, going back to the 8th century. So they, you know, they gave us a lot of the idea of sound government. Kind of wish they were running this place right now at the moment, actually. They were very bureaucratic. Mm. They were very focused on making everything work properly. And a lot of that came, that idea of organized government, and especially republican government, came from them. So it's an astonishing place, given that it's so small, you know, really. You can walk across it.
Yeah, no, it's funny. You can tell from the way you're enthusiastic about this stuff that this is the kind of thing that comes in, this sort of background to the stories. And that's fascinating, I think, for us as readers. Just looking back on something then with the Nick Costa, which was the longest running series, I think 9 books in 10 years. I mean, you must get a lot of readers who say to you, you know, are you going back? Is that something that you just move on and you just think, well, you know, that was then?
I do. I mean, you know, publishing is, everybody thinks that authors are masters of their own fates. And believe me.
Yeah, I kind of did.
We're really not. We really aren't. You know, those first books were written for one publisher. And then another publisher took the first 3 books off that publisher, who were losing interest in them because I'd moved on to other things. So then there was a split between 2 publishers. Now that publisher has taken over the rest of the series, and a lot of them haven't been available. They weren't exactly out of print because they didn't even have the ebooks available for some reason.
Right.
So they will all be republished. The whole series will be out again soon. Probably most popularly as inexpensive paperbacks. But the only place I could write a new Nick Costa would be to follow on with that series with that publisher. And right. I'm not sure I want to do it, but I'm not sure it really worked. I feel I kind of moved on from those books. You know, they were kind of Roman Ed McBain 87 Precinct books.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, they were nice. I love doing them, and they're great characters, and people are all saying, "But love to have more Nick Costa." I did do a 10th one called The Savage Shore a few years back to test the water, and it did okay, but I think people move on, you know, and I think writers have to move on. So I can't, much as I'd love an excuse to go back to Rome, I can't really see it happening, I'm afraid.
No, fair enough. Well, people are told. But the thing is, you are moving on with other series and that. And I think one of those things is I think you're pretty much an innovator too. I mentioned to Barry Forshaw, you know, that I was coming along to interview you here. And he said, my first recollections of David are when he used to do tech articles for the papers.
He always says that.
He always says that.
The Sunday Times, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, but it made me think about something, because then let's move that into the publishing era. And I think you're one of the first people who really got into the Audible thing. And you did mention it very briefly there. But, of course, that led to this Shakespeare stories coming out as Audibles and the partnership with Richard Armitage and everything.
Yeah.
I mean, so you clearly like to connect as many ways as you can and to keep up with things as well. So tell us a little bit about that series, please.
I always thought audio was a fantastic medium because if you think about it, once again, I'm a storyteller. Storytelling did not start with books. Storytelling started with poets and audio. You know, Homer was not an author. Homer was a poet and a singer. So audio always fascinated me. And I'm a very good friend of mine, Steve Feldberg at Audible. We were at a Thriller Fest, I think it was about 2010 in New York. And Steve said to me, I want to do something different, you know, in audio, a pure audio original. Have you got any ideas? And I said, no, I haven't, not one, you know. But I did a signing that evening, and the chap sitting next to me, I'm Hewson, he's Hartley. A.J. Hartley is a professor of Shakespeare
right. In
North America. He's English. And we were just chatting away, and I said to Andrew, has anybody ever tried rewriting Shakespeare, and ignoring the language and just trying to pull out the story as a narrative? And he said, no, somebody must have done. They must have done. But we couldn't think of anybody. And I saw Steve from Audible afterwards. And I said, how about if we did Macbeth? Totally rewrite Macbeth in contemporary language and gave you the story. And being Steve, he just said straight away, yeah, let's do it. And we did it. And that was narrated by Alan Cumming. It was absolutely brilliant. Mm. And then we did Hamlet with Richard, who was absolutely brilliant. And then I did those were both with Andrew. And then on my own, I did Romeo and Juliet with Richard, which won us an Audi, like an Audi Oscar.
Yeah, right.
And I learned a lot from that, because there's a lot that writers can learn from actors. There's a lot that we can learn from performance, because audio is very unforgiving of lazy writing. It's very unforgiving of lazy dialogue tagging. You know, if you do he said, she said right. repeatedly.
Yeah, it gets boring quickly.
Awful. Mm. It sounds awful in audio. So it changed the way I write.
Mm.
I wrote because I now always write with audio in mind. And one thing I've discovered is that everything that makes for a good audio book makes for a good book.
Right.
So I really recommend people to, if they can, talk to actors who are doing their audio about what they think's working and most of all what they think doesn't work, because that's where you really learn what's going wrong is, when you get them to say, well, actually, that's quite difficult. That's a speed bump. Because you're always trying to take speed bumps out of your writing. So, I was very lucky to do a lot of audio. It's fascinating. Now audio is huge. But I remember about 10 years ago, one of my editors said, why are you wasting time on audio when you could be writing books? It's such small stuff. And I said, well, I don't think it's going to be small for much longer, but also it's fun. I mean, when you're working with class actors like Alan Cumming and Richard, you learn a lot from them. And they bring something to your work that you didn't put in there in the first place. So it's been a real learning experience for me. I've been very lucky. Yeah.
And as you say,
I hope to do more audio originals. I don't think there'll be Shakespeare. I think we've moved on from that.
No, because you did other novels anyway, didn't you, as audio books?
Yeah, I've done others. But it is a very interesting medium that it's just grown like Topsy, I mean, there's somebody telling me
absolutely.
That they're thinking that, the actual audio market will be bigger than the ebook market at some stage.
Right. I certainly know a lot of authors who are trying to get in there. They've realized the potential that is there for audio books. So, and it's kind of in the Shakespeare context, you're bringing to a contemporary audience a story that maybe in some ways they can't access. I mean, I think, unfortunately, too many people do Shakespeare at school and get a bad experience out of it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And so anything that helps to let them see the essence of the story is a brilliant idea.
Yeah. And, and they are great stories. And, Shakespeare nicked the stories himself, so I don't feel any shame in nicking his story and changing it for a different kind of audience, which we did very much with all of them. We did change things because there are huge... I mean, Andrew, being a professional academic, could say, well, we don't really know what's going on there. We're not even sure Shakespeare even wrote that bit. Mm. So it's a very interesting area, but they are great stories. Having done Macbeth, Hamlet, and Romeo and Juliet, I think those are probably the three most popular.
Mm.
I can't see another one that I'd want to do. Maybe Richard III, but...
Yeah, some of the others are problematic. I mean, Othello and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm. So we're talking about places. You told stories all over the world, in a sense, I could go into too many of those, but let's concentrate on one, because we haven't talked about these books, the Amsterdam stories, the Peter Voss series.
Yeah.
I suppose the question is kind of, how does that come about? How does that story grab you, or you grab the story in a place like Amsterdam? What sort of brought that about?
It came about just through practicalities, really. I did the three Killing books, which were great fun. I spent a lot of time in Copenhagen. And at the end of those books, I talked to my then editor about, what we're going to do next. And they said, well, we don't want you to go back to Rome. We want you to go somewhere. And at the time, Scandi Noir was the big thing. It wasn't Mediterranean. People wanted to move north. And the Killing books did phenomenally well around the world, but especially in the Netherlands. And I'd spent quite a bit of time promoting them in Holland with the publisher there, who I liked very much. And I said to the publisher there, I'm thinking of setting something somewhere new. Would you help me with local import, for setting it in Amsterdam? And they said, yeah, love that idea. So it came about... It came about through that, really. We were looking for a new location. And I did the four books, which I enjoyed greatly. I think, as usual with the series, they improve as they go along. I think the fourth book is the best of them. Whether I'll end up going back to Amsterdam to do another one, I don't know. Possibly.
Okay. We'll leave that there. You mentioned The Killing again, then. I think... this is relevant, I suppose, in a way, to Baptiste, because The Killing is the novelization of the Danish TV series. I mean, how did that come about?
I was approached. It's very simple. You know, I was approached, there was a big contest among publishers to get the book rights for The Killing. And my then publisher wanted them and came to me and said, look, you've got a lot of experience writing foreign locations and you write strong female characters. Mm-hmm. We decided that you're the one to write it. Are you interested? And I said, well, yeah, you know, if you win it. And they did win it. But one of the conditions was that I wanted the right to be able to change it.
Right.
Because as we all know, when they take a book and turn it into TV, there are changes along the way because they're different media. Mm. So I didn't really see it as a novelization. Mm-hmm. So those are just basically photocopies of the script.
Yeah, right.
This is an adaptation. And that's why in all three Killing books, the endings are different.
Yes.
And some of them, you know, some of them are quite significantly different to the original TV. Not because I thought the TV didn't work. It's just that on TV, things change. You can't get away with things that right. you do on TV in the book.
Yeah.
I mean, I think a similar example is the ending. TV always struggles with endings and often just says, okay, he did it. Now go and yes. put the kettle on. Now, when a book ends, things need to resolve a bit. People need to look back at the story that they've been through and think, oh, okay, yes, now it makes sense. Mm. And in TV, that often doesn't happen.
There isn't the need for that moment of logic where the reader goes, right.
You don't have that. You know, and also people don't flick back on TV and look at, you know, a scene from three episodes back to try to understand it better, whereas with a book, you often have that in your head. So I was very lucky. I mean, Søren Sveistrup, who was the inventor of The Killing, was very open, just said, look, you change what you want. You know, I trust you. You don't need to come to me and agree to it. And that's what I did with those books. And again, that was a learning experience because I was working with drama. You know, I was seeing the way they did their plot lines mm-hmm. over in the Danish TV stories with studios where there would be post-it notes on the walls in different colors for the ABC storylines and how they went across each episode. So, you know, I learned a lot about how they approach structuring a story, which I think, again, has changed the way I write. You know, I tend to write these days in a way that follows the rhythm of a TV series. You know, I mean, with Baptiste, you know, it's divided into parts, but you can easily think of each part as an episode of TV.
Yes, that's what I mean.
And you want them to be around the same length because that's what readers expect. You know, they don't want to read something that's like 3,000 words and find the next one's 30,000 because that throws their rhythm. So I think, it was a really fascinating experience. I love doing those books.
I think I probably should have said adaptation rather than the novelization.
Because that's right. Everybody calls it novelization.
I knew damn well, but I was also acutely aware that this changes again with Baptiste because Baptiste, The Blade Must Fall, is another. You're much freer with this story because you really are now Absolutely. Taking on an invention of a character, and we'll talk about that in sort of details in a bit. But first question again is really the same. It's sort of how did it come about?
Oh, again, I was approached.
Right.
I mean, because of The Killing, I've been approached variously over the years to do TV books. And whenever I say I'd only do it, I don't want to do it really, but I'd only do it if you let me change it. You know, most of them run a mile because TV people want to control every aspect of it. And they think they've got it perfect right first time. They don't see why a mere writer, an author should change their brilliant work. So, you know, I never did any of that. But I was approached by Orion, who said, did you watch The Missing and Baptiste? And I said, it was good TV. I said, but I'm not doing a book of those things. He said, no, that's not what we want is, could you imagine writing the book with him, say, 40 years younger? Mm. And the somehow, whatever the story is, hooks into the person that we've seen on TV, this obsession with missing people. And I'm a sucker for crazy challenges. You know, I'm sure there's a note in publishing somewhere that says, if you've got a really bizarre idea, phone Houston, you know, he'll do it. And I just thought, that's so interesting. I've never been approached with anything like that before. But I wasn't convinced until I thought, okay, let's say it's going to be 1976. What was France like in 1976? I didn't set foot in France. I was a reporter on a lowly local newspaper in Hemel Hempstead. You know, right. It's just way, I had no idea what France was like. So I started reading up, and I knew about the student riots, but they were in 1968. So it was all after that. And then I came across this fact that until 1977, the French would send people to the guillotine,
yeah,
which horrified me. I mean, we talked about anger earlier. You know, I get really angry about capital punishment because I didn't see any government has the right to take away someone's life. And as soon as I got that, I thought, we know that Baptiste is a decent guy. Imagine he nicks someone for a murder. And he expects he will get the life sentence. Most murderers got the life sentence. It's only really nasty cases where they sent them to the guillotine. But then something happens with the guy, the suspect, that means he's sent to the guillotine. How would Baptiste feel about that? He'd be awful. He'd feel really bad. Mm. And then to take it one step further, so that on the day when the guy's either going to be executed or given a reprieve to a life sentence, he asks to see Baptiste and talks in this very circular way about what's happened.
Yes.
And I just thought, that's it. You know, you only need that what if, you know, to get a story started, that eureka moment. And that was it. And as soon as I had that, and I think over about 3 days, I just wrote a kind of, not so much a synopsis, but saying, look, this is how I'd see the story developing. This is where I think it would be.
Right.
Sent it off to them. The TV people loved it. Ryan loved it. And here we are. So that's how it came about.
It's really interesting. You know, you mentioned the idea there of guillotining, and it was, the last one was 1977. I mean, I was a child at the time, but I do remember this. Maybe it was a morbid obsession, but I was kind of obsessed with that. And Spain also, where they had the garrote at that time.
Well,
you know, and I've always, like you, I think it's a kind of ultimate failure of society if we become the murderer, the same as the murderer, you know. Where's the difference? One is official and it's dressed up with fancy procedure. So it's worse, if anything. And I thought that was a fascinating thing. I did wonder how much you wanted to explore that within the novel, because funnily enough, the argument in the background, there's some talking amongst the characters. It comes from an unusual source, in fact, the first time somebody mentions, you know, being opposed to it. We kind of get a sense of Baptiste anyway. But so it is about social issues, in a sense. I suppose then this novel, the crime novel, in a sense, it's a very good way of getting across that kind of thing. And for me, that also kind of did sum up a bit of what France was at that time, from what I remember.
I mean, one of the people who talks about it, I read a bit about executioners, not just French ones, but Pierpont, who was the hangman in England. All of them said, after capital punishment was abolished, they thought it was a really terrible idea.
Yes, right.
All of them. And they're the ones who'd seen it, you know. So the idea that it was something that, you know, people thought was great, it wasn't really there. I mean, it was much more nuanced than that. And I wanted to bring that across. I mean, and Baptiste clearly is shocked and appalled that this is on the cards and doesn't understand why. And we don't really understand why until to the very end of the story.
Yes, right.
But that was the context. I mean, I think, you know, for a project like this, it's really important to be organized. You know, I really needed to have the location, the time, the characters, and the rough development of it. I don't write a huge synopsis, you know, scene by scene or anything, but I needed to have the world of the book in my head before I started writing it. And that was essential. So and things like that really helped.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I vaguely remember, you know, the summer, it was the hot summer 76 over here, that to some extent in the book as well, you know. How much then is there sort of this historical research, you know, where you go back to the books, you can look online, whatever. But there's also, I suppose, memory And I know you said, you know, you weren't in France, you didn't know France as such. But we have a kind of memory of that time, don't we? And also sort of a feel. And as much as everything, you talk about all the factors you can create in the book, and we'll talk about those specifically as we go along. But it's about the feel that also is then the mood of the book, if you like. Mm. And you get a great sense of that. So what I'm kind of asking in a way is how much of it is sort of something that you can call on in that sense, rather than just the idea of looking it up in a book, if you like.
Well, for years, I'd had it at the back of my head that the summer of 1976 would be great for setting a story
right.
where people are trapped and sweating. And I mean, I remember I was living in Luton at the time. And I mean, now we're kind of used to heat waves. We don't think about it very much. But at the time, right. you know, nobody had experienced anything like it. There were water shortages. Things were breaking down because of the heat. It was, you know, on one hand, people were saying this is brilliant. You know, it's like having a holiday. But there was a lot of tension and pressure that comes with heat. Yeah. If you actually talk to a police officer, they will tell you that the best way to stop riots is for it to rain and get cold. So they can directly relate the willingness of people to riot to the heat. So I always thought that would be a great place to start. And then beyond that, the big question was, where is it going to take place? Because normally I set stories in real locations, as you know, and I do a phenomenal amount of research, you know, far too much, far more than is necessary. And, you know, my first thought was, well, should I set this in Paris? What was Paris like in 1976? And I just thought that would require so much research to go back to 1976 just to get a picture of it in my head. Would it really add anything to the book? Because most of the people reading it, they wouldn't know Paris in 1976.
No.
So I thought, you know, I'm going to invent somewhere. And I vaguely know from, because I live in Kent and we used to travel over the channel a bit when it was a lot easier than it is today. So I know the Pas de Calais and Picardy and that area. I mean, and I thought, and that was quite a poor area of France in the 1970s. It was mining, there were steelworks. It was a little bit deprived, although it has some quite posh looking small towns. And so I thought I would invent a place roughly in the Pas de Calais, Picardy area where the story takes place. And the great thing was when Checky Carrier, who plays Baptiste, narrates the audiobook brilliantly. I mean, you hear his voice and it's like you can see the glass of pastis and the disque bleu already. And when I met Checky just before recording, we were talking, he said, you know, when I read the book, I kept Googling to find out where Clermier was because I'd never heard of it. And it sounded so real, I wanted to go. And I said, well, I made it up. You know, it's just invented. He said, no, I know that now. He said, but, you know, to him, it felt like a real part of Northern France. So that was a great compliment. But yeah, that, you know, getting the timing right and getting the place right was really important to me.
Yeah, and it does come across in the book, because what we have here is a small town. One of the good things about that is, of course, Baptiste is, let's talk about him a little bit, I suppose, in a way to set it up. He's a very young character. This is his first major case as a detective. So this is his first defining moment, in a sense, isn't it? That's what you've created here.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the things I wanted to do was to set him up with an experience that would explain why 40 years later...
Yes.
He can't turn someone down if they say someone's gone missing. I mean, when you watch the TV, it is quite extraordinary. I can't remember which series it is, but someone who's basically a complete stranger just comes up to him and says, you know, someone's gone missing, I need some help. And he just straight away just says, I will help you.
Right.
No, you know, it will cost or anything like that. It's just, I will help you. And that is, you know, that is very unusual. Now, I wanted to find out why he was like that. And, to do that, I didn't want to take anything really from the TV series. I just wanted to think about his character. And, you know, he's mid-60s, mid to late 60s. He's a very decent man. He's very intelligent. He's very dogged and persistent. He can be quite aggressive. He can be quite arrogant. He can turn violent if pushed. So I took all of those things and I tried to imagine what he would be like 40 years younger. And, you know, the arrogance is still there. The temper is still there. You know, he is a Parisian, so he thinks, you know, everybody's
that's it. Not he's got that outsider.
Mm. Yeah. So, you know, I built him up from that.
And a little bit of naivety about him as well.
Yeah, he is. Yeah. But he, you know, he's come from Paris and he's in this small town that is basically rotten. Mm. And I think a part of him doesn't understand that a small town could be like that. Now, I don't know what small towns were like in France at the time, but, you know, I came from a small town in Yorkshire, a seaside town, and that was rotten. You know, we had Jimmy Savile going around doing what Jimmy Savile did. Right, nobody knew what was going on. Everybody knew what was going on.
Yeah.
But he got away with it. So, that you know, I think, you know, he is naive because he doesn't understand that actually a small town could be like that under the surface. And as the story goes on, you can feel him sort of thinking, there is something really wrong here. And I can't put my finger on it. But, you know, there's something that's germane to this story. And I think that it sets him up for this obsession he's got later in life with when somebody goes missing, you know, it's like a death.
Mm.
It probably is a death, you know, but it's something he just...
In some ways, it's sort of an extra thing with it, though, because there's that not knowing too.
Exactly. Mm. And the not knowing is, you know, probably worse than knowing.
The way you put it there, that actually explains a lot of the sort of tension that's in the novel, because we've got him growing and developing and learning and starting to get a sense of what's wrong. And at the same time, I think we are, as readers anyway, haunted by the fact that we don't know whether the truth will come out. And that's the essential all the way through. We're hoping, we're looking for that truth to come out. But the tension is there the whole time as we don't find it out. And of course, that gives you the chance to explore this landscape. So it's not just about the place itself, which is a very claustrophobic sort of rural environment. We talked about the temperature, and you do set that up really very nicely. You certainly get a sense of place. But it's how people are in those places that is the character as well. And this is very much about a town that has those divisions within it. I mean, there's a lot of privilege. There's people who basically feel they own the town.
Mm.
Then there's people from the wrong side of town, as far as they're concerned, and they're looked down on. And all of these factors, you know, the wealth, the difference between the two communities, it all plays into this sort of, it all plays into the story, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I wanted to bring out is that very often when we have missing person stories, particularly if they're set in the modern day, there's this massive response. You know, there's helicopters in the sky, there are appeals, there are finger searches in the woods. And the truth is, it ain't like that. The young girl who's gone missing is 19 years old. She's only recently moved to the town. She's black. The local police chief just says, you know, 19-year-old kid's gone. You know, they walk out, they run away, they've got a boyfriend. It's no big deal. He doesn't care. So there is nothing. There's only really Baptiste and this other guy, another stranger who has been lent to him, Etienne Fatoussi. They're the only ones who are saying, well, you know, we think there's actually more to this than meets the eye. But everybody else is just saying, well, you know, it's just this black kid. She's run away. The parents are a bit weird. They're from the wrong side of town. Who cares? And I think that is true. I mean, you know, often missing person stories do miss the fact that if the missing kid is young, white, photogenic, and comes from a white, photogenic, middle-class family, people care a lot more than if it's a black kid from a family, possibly an immigrant, who was on the wrong side of town. You know, there is that divide there, and that's very, very clear in this story.
Yes.
That for most of the people on the Brit side of town is, well, you know, it's just not a big deal. You know, she'll turn up, she'll run away, who knows, you know. And I think that actually is a more... certainly in terms of 1976, is a more accurate way to approach the story than pretending that there would be some massive police response to a 19-year-old who's just vanished.
No, absolutely. And that does come across. And one of the things that comes across with it, though, at the same time is, of course, we see the effect that this has on Baptiste and his colleagues as policemen, the ones who care, you know, the ones who do make an effort, the ones who don't, and all the things that are going on in the higher end of society at the same time, but also the family. You know, this girl has a family. Then there's the boy who's being, well, man, Gilles, who's being he's facing execution, waiting for the president's final word on it. And that comes across very much in the book, that, you know, violence has real consequences, and it does. It's, you know, it stops you in your tracks at times when you start to think about it. Looking at that, you said then really that you didn't want to be too influenced by the series, and that's fair enough. What you're doing here, I suppose, in a sense, is you're setting up that rage and the demons that are in his mind when we see him 40 years later. You're putting them there in the first place, so it's an entirely original concept. But and you took the Misper idea, you know, that was the thing with the young girl. How much of it did you actually take from the series? And what about Checky's role as well? You know, the way he played it. Is that, how relevant is that, I suppose?
Checky's role was very important because, you know, I watched him to think, you know, who is this guy and where has he come from? One of the things I took from it is that he struck me as somebody who didn't stay in any one place for a long time. I kind of imagined that he was the kind of character who everybody admires and quite likes and regards as intelligent, but he's too stiff and unbending and awkward at times to have around very much. So, you know, that's why, you know, he's in Clermier because he's been kicked out of Paris, probably he's upset someone. And I think he's that kind of peripatetic sort of detective, which is great, actually. I mean, if there are more of these books, I think that actually gives them a real edge rather than having somebody who's static in the same place with the same crew all around him. But I took that, but I didn't take a lot from the series. Now, I didn't want it to feel, you know, the series are very much modern stories. You know, there is the massive, you know, in the Missing, the first Missing, there is this massive police presence that turn up. And I didn't, that's very much what I didn't want to happen. I didn't want that to happen. So I didn't really take that. And I had no contact the TV people at all. You know, that was the other thing that, you know, when you do these things, it's very important just to have your book editor as your boss rather than have, you know, a committee.
Yeah, you don't want a committee. No.
You can't work like that. It was basically Checky was what I focused on.
Yeah.
Checky and his wife, you know, Celia is quite an interesting relationship there.
No, I thought that would be the case, but I also was aware at the time that this is a very original piece of work. I don't think it'd be half as interesting to talk about this book as if it was something that just related to the series in that way. It just gives that series the logic. You know, when you look at it, you can still get a sense of that. One of the things you point out about him, I suppose, in the book is also that he's just not a policeman in a sense that he doesn't think like a policeman. He doesn't have those sensibilities at all. And that's what makes him interesting.
And I didn't want to get bogged down with, you know, actual police procedure. I don't know what that would be, to be honest, in France. I mean, I don't even say what his rank is, you know.
No, right.
People probably don't notice that, but I mean, he's just a detective. I didn't want to get into all that procedural bit because, you know, whenever he says, you know, I think we could get the fingerprint guys or a cameraman in here, they'll just say, what? Well, you know, that has to come in from miles away and why bother? You know, he doesn't have access to any of that. But I mean, the other thing about, you know, linking to the TV series is you have to bear in mind that probably as many people by the book will not have seen the TV as
Yeah.
I mean, I found that with the killing, you know, people would say they went to the book first and then they went to the TV.
Right.
I remember doing a very funny event in Scarborough because the first book has a very different ending to the TV ending. And this lovely lady came up and said, I absolutely loved the book. It was fantastic. Now, I went and watched the TV series afterwards, but I don't understand, why did they change your ending? Because your ending was so much better. And I said, well, they're TV people. They're like,
yeah, well,
you know,
that's them. That's what they're like.
So, you know, it has a life of its own outside the TV. But we'll see. I mean, we'll see what the response is. I mean, Baptiste was very popular around the world, as I now know from lots of.
Having said that, you make a very good point. One thing is, this would stand on its own. If I didn't know a Baptiste series and I read this book,
wouldn't matter.
No, it wouldn't matter at all. I'm reading a book that's got an original story in it with a, you know, character, your fascinating character who's being created, you know. So No, I think it perfectly works that way. One of the things about it, of course, being 1976, is that there is no CCTV, there are no mobile telephones, and there's no DNA. I mean, is that releasing? Is it? Does it make it easier to work with character?
It's wonderful, absolutely wonderful. It just makes life so much more interesting. You know, I mean, the reality of, you know, modern policing today. I mean, I remember going to, I think it was an FBI seminar in the States, where they talked about what happened when there was a missing person or a murder. And, you know, the first thing these guys are doing is sitting around looking at phone signals from masts.
Right, yeah, yeah.
You know, that is, you know, that is what the whole basis of interesting detection stories is, this idea that you have this intellectual character who's trying to unravel a puzzle that may have been set by an equally intellectual character, you know, kind of Moriarty figure. And, you know, the reality of policing is not like that these days. I mean, it has become so tech-oriented that it was a delight not to have to work with that. I mean, I don't know. I don't have any plans to write a sort of direct police procedural that will be set in present day. But, I mean, the research for that would be considerable and probably really tedious, you know? I mean, it's basically a lot of people sitting around looking at computers, asking whose turn it is to go out and buy the pizza. You know,
no, you could bog a book down. I mean, I think, yeah, you want, it's always, I suppose, with things of details, you want these light touches, don't you, that kind of spark something in the reader's mind rather than anything else.
Yeah.
But it does.
Again, I mean, it's people. It's about people. Mm. You know, books are about people. Yeah. And, you know, you're only getting computers and phone masks and phone signals. And, you know, just the fact that, you know, everybody knows where everybody is now because you've got Google Maps following you everywhere. I mean, there is no privacy anymore. That is just death to fiction, really, I think. Death to storytelling, if you're going to let it trap you in there.
Yeah, because what you want is this interaction between people. Some people are going to tell the truth. Some people are going to lie to Baptiste, and he has to try and figure out where the reality, where the truth is in all of this. Mm. One of the aspects of the book is that you also get to draw in on French history this time. I mean, Josephine Baker, God, Marxism, Le Corbusier, there's quite a lot, but the Josephine Baker is relevant. We won't tell people why, but it is. And also the Marquis de Sade comes in as well.
Yeah.
And I suppose it's a reflection that it kind of grounds the story, but at the same time, one of the things about it is that we are a reflection of the past, aren't we? You know, everything we are now, it does relate to the philosophies, the things that come down over time. And so it must be fun playing with that, putting those into the book.
Very, very much so. Very much so in France. And Gilles Mailloux, the guy who's in prison, is I really liked him because he, you know, he is this working class kid who left school at 15, and he works in a petrol station at night. But he is highly intelligent and very well read. And knows his history. I mean, he's the one who's feeding bits of history to Baptiste about the place. He's telling him that, oh, yeah, Marquis de Sade was in that prison for a while after he escaped jail. And you know, it becomes apparent that he also understands French poetry. He's appreciates Aubrey Beardsley. You know, he's a self-taught kind of guy who's got very wide-ranging and eclectic tastes that kind of mirror the, you know, the almost alternative movement of the mid-1970s. There's a lot of France. I wanted to get a lot of France in there. And I checked it out with some French people I know. Hopefully I've got it right.
No, I'm sure you have. And it makes a lot of sense. And it kind of gives a real lovely flavor to the book as well, you know. Because it is about that, the background to it too. And I'm going to start talking where I should be saying things I'm not saying, so I won't. So you set it up at the end for another Baptiste. So we can expect, I suppose, that this is, well, at least for a little while, we have a series on the run here.
I'd be interested in doing it. We haven't actually talked about that because the book's not out yet. We'll have to see how it goes.
Of course, right.
We have talked about it, and it, you know, it's a possibility. Mm. It's not a certainty. I'd certainly be interested in doing more because I think there is a kind of book to be written with that character that is unusual. As I said, I see him as an itinerant, as somebody who's peripatetic. So you could easily have him moving around through European history of around that era at interesting times and interesting places, doing whatever Baptiste does. So yeah, I think it could show a lot of promise for more stories. But we'll see. We'll see.
What about the idea of it feeding back the other way then, and to TV as an origin story for Baptiste?
The option's there if anybody wants to take it up. I mean, the two brothers behind Baptiste are incredibly busy. I mean, they did The Tourist and they would have first pick if they wanted to do that. There are always issues with historical TV to do with cost. It costs a lot more money to recreate something from the 1970s. You've got to get the cars and the costumes and everything. And I know, you know, with the Garden of Angels, I mean, I did have quite a bit of film and TV interest in that, but it all came down to people saying it will cost a fortune, you know, to try to recreate the Venice of 1943. So we shall see. Those things, you know, if they turn up, they turn up. But I don't really count on them. I just try to write the best book I can. And,
I just put it out there because I think it's a brilliant idea. And I think, as you
said, I think it would make great. So. I mean, you know, as I said, it is written as 7 episodes, one of which is a little bit shorter than the others, but that's because of book reasons rather than anything else. And I do want it, you know, because it's come from TV, I want it to read a bit like TV. Mm. You know, there's a great word in German called, which I learned from Audible, called Kopfkino, which means cinema of the head. And you know that thing where you get a little movie runs through your head, you know, you've nearly just been run over by a bus and you get a little movie saying that's what it would have been like. Kopfkino is what you're trying to achieve with audio.
Right.
With the narrator and with your story.
Yes.
And it's also something that I think you can try to achieve in a book, you know, which is why I'm always quite rigid with each part being divided into scenes, making it very clear whose point of view it is, letting people know what the atmosphere is like, what the place is like. You know, I do try to set each scene.
Yes, I see what you mean.
In dramatic terms, because I think that helps the reader get a bit of Kopfkino, rather than, you know, writing for writing's sake. I have done that. I think in my earlier books, you know, I felt I was doing more writing than storytelling, and now I try to just focus on the storytelling. And I think the book really works well if people don't notice the writing, you know, if it's just there to create the story in their head.
And you're with the characters and you're getting a sense of it as it goes.
Yeah. And hearing their voices, you know, the dialogue and even their voices,
No, that makes a lot of sense. One last question then. How about a recommendation of something maybe you've read or seen recently, I don't mind which, or something that you know, hold dear that you would offer to?
I mean, the thing I'm completely obsessed with at the moment is Shogun.
Right.
I
haven't had a chance to see it yet.
That is the most wonderful TV. And every time I look at it, I just think you've blown more in 5 minutes budget than I could imagine. I mean, the costumes, the acting, the storytelling is just superb. And I vaguely remember Shogun from the Clavell book.
Right, yes.
Years and years ago. And I don't remember it being quite as vivid as this. I mean, it is astonishing piece of TV.
Out of their way to make sure it had a Japanese focus as well, though, didn't they? I think they.
Oh yeah,
I mean, the Japanese, you know, whereas Clavell was writing a thriller.
Yeah. No, the Japanese speak Japanese, but I mean, Clavell got a lot of the history right of that period. I mean, when I was a journalist on the Sunday Times, I went to Japan a fair bit. And it is a fascinating country because it still has its own culture that is so different to everybody else's, and it hasn't been homogenized. And you see this coming through. So, yeah, that is, I've got a new episode of that tonight. And happily, they're not releasing it all in one, so you have to wait, which I think is a good idea. But I can imagine I'll be going through all that again. And the acting is just fantastic. That's my recommendation at the moment.
Well, I put that in the program notes, but also absolutely will make a note to watch it myself. David, that's been brilliant. Thank you very much.
Oh, well, thank you, Paul. All the best, and I hope to see you on the road somewhere along the way.
Indeed.
Well, a huge thank you to David Hewson for a brilliant chat. I think it's absolutely fascinating to hear about how you create a prequel as an original novel to a television series like that. Baptiste, The Axe Must Fall is available in hardback, ebook, and audible. I haven't heard it, but if it's done by Chechi Cario, it must be fantastic. And you can get it through all good book outlets. It's published by Orion. If you want to get it from us, you can click the link on the program notes, and that'll take you to bookshop.org and you can get it there. If you've enjoyed the show, please rate and subscribe with your favourite podcast provider. And naturally, I'll be back very shortly with another interview. But in the meantime, bye, and thank you very much for listening.